speaker JoJo, who is from the Bay Area.
I'm an addict. My name is JoJo. First and foremost, I'd like to thank God for another day clean and another day alive. It's only through God's grace and mercy that I'm here today. It's not my best decision that got me to Narcotics Anonymous. My best decision got me high every day. God's will and an intervention got me to Narcotics Anonymous. I want to thank CPR CNA for inviting me out, and it's an honor and a privilege, because a lot of days I question myself and how much, where I fit in the grand scheme of things when it comes to this program, and how much knowledge I have and how good of a program I work, and am I doing the things that are necessary to stay clean. I haven't done anything perfectly around here. The only thing that I've done perfectly since the day that I got here is stay clean, man. And, so to be asked to do something like this is definitely an honor. And I'd like to thank Phyllis, because that's how the steps are meant to be heard. For real. If you didn't listen to the literature that was read prior to the meeting, then you missed the program of Narcotics Anonymous. The program is the steps, the traditions, and the concepts. The program isn't what I'm going to share. What I'm going to share is my experience, strength, and hope. The fifth tradition tells me that that is the only thing that I have to share, and that's what I share up here. I'm not the program, and I'll never claim to be the program. So luckily we're in a convention, so if you didn't listen to the readings this time, maybe next time you can listen to the readings and get something out of it. I will read a little bit out of the basic text because I like to, and I always read this before I do every meeting in the fifth tradition that I just referenced, because it's very important for me to remember what my primary purpose as a Narcotics Anonymous member when I share a meeting. It says the last two paragraphs in the fifth tradition say, what would happen if our groups had any other primary purpose? We feel like our message would be diluted and then lost. If we concentrated on making money, many might get rich. If we were a social club, we could find many friends and lovers. If we specialized in education, we would end up with many smart addicts. If our specialty was medical help, many would get healthy. If our group purpose were anything other than to carry the message, many would die and few would find recovery. What is our message? The message is that an addict, any addict, can stop using drugs, lose the desire to use, and find a new way to live. Our message is hope, and the promise is freedom. When it's all said and done, our primary purpose can only be to carry the message to the addict who still suffers, because that's all we have to give. The topic of this meeting is never too young, never too old, never too young to recover. So it's easy for me. I can tell my story, and it just goes right along with never too young to recover. And I always get lucky with topics like this. Usually when I get a topic and it's something out of left field, I feel like I have to prepare for it. But never too young is my story. I'm going to share my experience, strength, and hope, and tell you why I'm here, how I got here, what I've done since I've been here, and what keeps me here. I come from an atypical household, a pretty typical household for an addict, man. I come from a broken home, divorced parents, abusive relationship with my dad. You know, the whole gamut. We hear it around here, man, you know. And I come from a family of all addicts, of using addicts. I don't believe that it's anybody's fault that I use. I don't believe that it's anybody's fault that I have the disease of addiction. Our literature talks about having the disease of addiction well before we ever pick up. I believe that I was born with the disease of addiction. I could say that I showed addict traits well before I picked up. When I was 7 or 8 years old, I always tell the story. When I was 7 or 8 years old, my first drug of choice was attention. And my mom liked to smoke crack, and she had this pager, right? And any time she gave me her pager number and showed me how to pager, and anytime anything happened in my life, I paged my mom. right? Anytime, anything happened. It was anything. And there was no magnitude. And I always paged your 911 on the end because everything in my life was an emergency when I was 8 years. And with that, what, and I can identify with that today, is that's the want for love. That was the want for somebody there to tell me that I'm okay, I'm good enough. Because, like, I remember as a little kid never feeling good enough. I remember feeling like, you know, all these other kids in the schools that I was going to were like, they had better family lives than I did. They had parents who were together. They lived in the nice house. They had the ideal 2.5 children and a white picket fence. And like, I lived in a one-bedroom apartment with me, my mom, and my sister. My mom was never home, and me and my sister raised ourselves. I can tell you the reason that I share about that, and I don't share my mom's story when I come up here because that's not my responsibility. I do touch on it though, because like my mom's clean today, but like I said, I come from a family of using addicts. My sister's 3 years older than me. Anything that I ever did as a kid, I did probably to impress my sister and her friends. I started, by the time I was 10 years old, I was smoking a pack of cigarettes a day and staying up as late as I wanted and doing whatever I wanted with my life. Like, I had no limits or boundaries as to what I could do as a kid. I just was completely off the hook by the time I was, you know, in fifth grade. What ended up happening, right, because my mom was caught up in the disease of addiction and the grips, and I had this, like, really abusive relationship with my dad. I would visit him every other weekend. We fought a lot, I went away one weekend to my dad's house, and when I came back to my house, everything in the house was packed up, and my mom moved to Florida. You know, she left in the weekend and never let me know ahead of time or anything like that, so for the first time in my life, I took somebody else's something and made it mine. I felt like it was my fault she left. I felt like, you know, I held on to that, like, for years. So I went and I moved in with my dad, and I went from living this lifestyle that I was accustomed to at 10 years old of being my own boss and being able to do whatever I wanted to, like, a completely the opposite. Like, my dad was like, he told me that I had a bedtime and dinner time, and he had food in the house. Like, when I was living with my mom, I used to go steal from the corner store because we didn't have food in the house. And we had, like, food in the house. And, like, I was like, you're not going to tell me what the fuck I'm going to do. You know what I mean? Like, I'm 10, 11 years old. You know what I mean? I got put in my place pretty quickly. Like I said, it was an abusive relationship. In the first month that I lived with my dad, I met his next door neighbor. I'm not going to get into a drug log, but the first time I ever picked up, I was in my dad's next door neighbor's house. His mom had a liquor cabinet. He told me if we drink the clear ones, his mom never drank, we can drink the clear ones and fill them back up with water and she would never know. And guess what? She never knew. That was the first time I fell in love with a feeling. At no point in the entire... Sorry. At no point in the entire time that I got high did I feel like I was good enough. I can say that with fact, that at no point in the entire time that I got high did I feel good enough. I just felt not as bad. I felt like I was just okay. I didn't have a weekend warrior story when I first picked up. The first time I picked up, I used every day. I fell in love with the idea that there was something that could almost fill that hole that I was feeling like every day of my life, and I used every day. For the next 6 years, six years or so, and like I said, I'm not going to get into a drug log, but We Do Recover says, when at the end of the road we find that we can no longer function as a human being, either with or without drugs, we all face the same dilemma. What is there left to do? I can tell you that in 6 years, I'd became homeless. I'd became a dirtball. I'd burned every bridge that was built for me. I had stolen from the people that showed me that they loved me. I had did whatever I could, getting and using and finding ways and means to get more were my lifestyle. Who is an addict says our living skills were reduced to the animalistic level, right? I was living in an abandoned apartment, sneaking in at nighttime, waiting for the maintenance men to get there in the morning so I could sneak out in the morning, walk up the street, and go to the school that I was registered to so that I could stay warm and find somebody to get high with. That was my story. Never too young to recover. I overdosed twice in the same day. New Year's of 2005 going into 2006 with the same people. I overdosed twice. And they told me that I had to leave this house that I was at because they were drug dealers, and right, if an ambulance had to come there, then they were going to get in trouble. So it wasn't like, you know, these friends that I had who told me that, like, you know, I was welcome to come use with them as long as I had some money to give to them to use, right? Told me that if the ambulance had to come, I was going to get into trouble, and or they were going to get into trouble. And, you know, the first spiritual awakening I had came before I found the rooms in Narcotics Anonymous. The first spiritual awakening I had came that day when the next morning when I woke up, all I wanted to do was use again. Like, it's something to, like, die and know that you've died and want to do the same thing that killed you the next day. I moved in with my grandmother, who's my biggest enabler, and lived in her basement with 5 using addicts in the house. And it was, we stole from each other. We used the same pawn shops to steal each other's stuff, to steal and sell each other's stuff. Like, you can't go into the pawn shop with somebody's TV that they just got and say, that's my laptop on the wall, and try to get it back while you're selling their stuff. You know what I mean? That's my story. And, like, we all stole from my grandmother and grandfather, who, like, worked hard to have to get everything that they had, and there was no remorse shown in the household whatsoever. We stole everything. Anything that wasn't tied down was getting taken out of the house. And see, what the problem was is, like, I always had a cop-out. I was the youngest, right? I was the youngest, so I was treated differently. I was treated like I wasn't that bad. So I was told all my life that I wasn't that bad. And I always had somebody to blame. And, like, my sister went to rehab, and I was living with 2 uncles and her boyfriend. And her boyfriend got kicked out. 1 uncle got clean. 1 uncle went to jail. My grandmother got her prescription to Vicodin, right? And they were gone the same day. And I didn't think it through that I didn't have anybody to blame for it anymore. When she asked me who took them, I said, he did, right? And I didn't have anybody to blame anymore, man. And that was the last bridge I burned. I went from being welcome into my grandmother's house to being isolated to her basement. She told me I wasn't welcome upstairs anymore. She told me it wasn't my place upstairs anymore. If I was going to continue to do the things I was doing, I was only welcome in her basement, and that was to make sure that I didn't die out there. And I was going to die out there. My sister got out of rehab in June of 2006. And she asked me to come to Narcotics Anonymous meeting with her. She told me, the allure was, right, she's dope fiending me into this thing, right? The allure was that there was going to be coffee and cookies at this meeting, and at that point in my life, coffee and cookies weren't a part of my story. And I went to this meeting, I got an armful of cookies and a cup of coffee. I started to penguin waddle back to the table. And my first experience with the Narcotics Anonymous meeting was 2 5-foot-7 bald guys came up and hugged me, right? Now look, I was living in Brooklyn, Maryland, and nobody hugs you in Brooklyn. And for the rest of that meeting, I watched my back to make sure that these guys weren't coming to try to hug me again later. And I told my sister that day that I never wanted to come back to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting again because it was really weird. And she proceeded to get me to go to another meeting by telling me that we could be there 5 minutes late, leave 5 minutes early, and I didn't have to hug anybody or do circle time at the end. And what happened was, is the seed was planted at that point. I didn't try to find recovery in June of 2006. I worked JoJo Anonymous. I went to one meeting a week. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't get a home group. I didn't work steps. I didn't take any of the suggestions, and I was allowed to smoke weed and drink, and that was it. And as long as that's what I did, I was going to be okay. What happened is October 20th of 2006, I wanted to die again. It took 4 months for me to want to go kill myself. And JoJo Anonymous then expired. I took my clean date's October 21st of 2006. I haven't found a need to use since that day. And the reason for that, and like I said, it hasn't been graceful. I haven't done this gracefully. My recovery's been based in two separate parts, right? And I always share that it's two separate parts of my recovery. My abstinence and my recovery. For my first 3 years, I was very abstinent, right? I did a lot of cruddy shit to a lot of people, and I didn't have any remorse, just like when I was using drugs. We can come around here and we can learn the literature and we can quote the book and we can sound real good and we can do all of that and we can dress up the outside and keep everything on the inside the same way that it is and we can prey on the newcomer like it talks about in the eighth step, which I did for 3 years. I remember, like, in 2009, I was sharing a youth and recovery meeting at the Free State Convention, and I got all prepared for this meeting because I wanted to wow everybody in the room. That was my only goal. My goal wasn't recovery. My goal wasn't to tell you, like, my experience. My goal was to make everybody go ooh and ah. I told a newcomer that weekend that if she wasn't, yeah, then she didn't have a place to stay at the convention. I realized that I was the same cruddy individual with 3 years clean, talking about working steps, talking about all of the things that I was doing in my life, and not doing any of them. I was working steps to make my hat match my shoes. I got a different sponsor right around that time, and I had a working knowledge of the third step, and I had a God of my understanding. And I wasn't really good at what it tells us to do in the 11th step, where it tells us to, you know, pray for God's will. I was very specific in prayer, and I said, God, help me stop sleeping with newcomers. That's the only prayer that I could get out when I had 3 years clean, because I felt like a piece of shit, and I was doing the same things, and then I slept with another newcomer, and she got pregnant. Right? And, like, my big thing around here is I like to save face and ass at the same time. And when you get a newcomer pregnant, you have some accountability that comes along with that. Regardless if you know it or not, there's some accountability that's gonna, if you want to save face, you have to do something different. And I'm happy to say that I've been in that relationship for almost 6 years now. With that newcomer, and I'm married today. The 12th step talks about selflessness. Selflessness was taught to me before I worked a 12th step, when I had my son. I got a daughter on the way, right? And that's one of the blessings of this program, right? Like, I wasn't capable of being a parent when I was out there. Never too, like, the topic of the meeting is never too young, right? Before I got here, I didn't have anything to lose. I didn't lose houses, jobs, cars, careers, and wives or anything like that. And, like, a guy broke it down to me really simply a long time ago, and he said, JoJo, how old do you have to be to die? And, ever since then, it's been like, I know that, like, I belong here. I know that I continue to go to meetings and continue to show up because this is where I belong. I can tell you, like, my experience with the steps for my first 3 years was very little. I can tell you that this time around, I have a sponsor who has taken me through 12, and, like, it's a lot different story this time around. The first step, it was really simple for me. Powerlessness and unmanageability were very apparent in my life. I didn't have any problem admitting that I was powerless or unmanageable in any area of my life, whether it be gambling at the poker table. And this is like, I'm talking about with like time clean. I've worked a first step again and know that like it's not about the drugs for me right now. It's about everything that I do that doesn't involve the third step and the 11th step that I try to use to fill the hole that tells me that it's going to fix me. And that can be gambling, that can be tennis shoes, that can be relationships, that can be anything that makes you tell me, you're looking good today. But guess what? One of those. That's all I get. And then from there, it's not good enough anymore. I'm on to the next one. And the second step was like my identification with God. Like I came in here and I didn't really have an understanding of a God of my understanding. And I was able to like trust in something other than myself. Like that something was going to happen in my life and I was going to gain something that I had lost, sanity. Could be restored to sanity. Not will be restored to sanity, could be restored to sanity. It's an action step. It's all about application. Like I tell my sponsees, man, like, you know, if you're, you can write it all you want, but if you ain't living it, you're not doing nothing. And the third step, like I said, I did have an understanding of the first go around, and like in working a deeper third step, I got really close with the God of my understanding, and like I used to pray for specifics, and like all, you know, it was really hard for me to turn all area of my will and my life. It was just like it was very hard for me to do that, and like it's still hard for me to do that, and like I like to take back sometimes. My third step sometimes is like take it now and give it back later, and like that's one of the biggest struggles that I still deal with. My fourth and fifth step, right? I don't have this Freddy Krueger story of the fourth step. I lived every bit of my fourth step well before I ever had to write it. So what's to be afraid of? The fifth step was my opportunity to get free with not only self, but sponsor and God. That was my opportunity to open up to somebody else and tell them, this is everything that I've done to this point in my life that I feel ashamed of. And also, because there's an asset section to the fourth step that sometimes people forget to mention, there's an asset section. This is also everything that I'm proud of in my life. I was able to share both of those with my sponsor and God and get good with self. Six and seven were the scary steps for me. Six was my opportunity to look at me for me now, not then, now. It was really easy to look at me then because I could say I've corrected that. But now, if I'm still living in defect, then I'm still doing, you know, if I'm living in defect rather than principle, then there's a change to be made, right? And when I worked my sixth step, I wrote a list of defects, pinned them up on the wall, stared at them every day because I was unwilling to go on to seven. And I pinned them up to my door, and every time I left my house, I had to stare at this list of defects. And I hated myself every day that I looked at that list. And until I was ready to go over them. And in working a seventh step, that was like my first real introduction to the spiritual principle of humility and understanding that as much as I like to believe that I'm God, and as much as I like to believe that I got this, and as much as I like to believe that everything that happens in my life is because of my power, not God's power, it's not the truth. The seventh step tells me that I need something outside of me to make me attention 5 minutes. To make me whole. To make me a spiritual being. To make me live in spiritual principles. I can't do it all alone. Eight and nine were really awesome because like in the eighth step I wrote a list of all those bridges I had burned, and I wrote a list of and check this out, right? It was easy to write everybody that I did dirt with when I was getting high. But like talk about writing an eight step list with 4.5 years clean, right? And having to put names on there of individuals in the rooms that I've harmed because of selfishness and self-centeredness telling me that like, you know, your feelings are invalid and don't matter. And I had to do that. And I had to make amends to people like that. I had to walk up to people in Narcotics Anonymous and apologize to them for being a piece of shit. The most rewarding thing I got from working eight and nine is a relationship with my dad. Me and my dad didn't speak for my first 2 years clean because we were in a I was in a place in my life where I didn't want to talk to him. We had a restraining orders against each other, fought tooth and nail. He put me out. It was crazy. And like, my son knows who Pop-Pop is today. That's the gifts of the program. That's the gifts of the program. The 10, 11, 12, man, and I went over a 10th step with a sponsee this weekend. 10, 11, and 12 are the maintenance steps. My 10th step tells me that I don't wait until the 4th step next time or the 8th and 9th step next time to tell you I'm wrong. It tells me that as soon as I identify the fact that I'm wrong, it is my responsibility to correct it at that point. Promptly admit when we're wrong. The 11th step tells me that I don't still sit around and pray for to stop sleeping with newcomers or money or whatever the case may be. I pray for the will of God, and I meditate and listen for God's answers, and I get it through the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous most of the time. And the 12th step is why I'm here today. The 12th step tells me that as long as I stay around here, it's my responsibility to be an active member of Narcotics Anonymous, and when I'm asked to do something, to do it and to show up under whatever terms. I don't say no to the program. If you're new, they tell you a lot of things. They tell you get a sponsor, get a home group, work the steps, get a service position, do this, do that, do the third. There's about 317 things people tried to shove down my throat in my first 2 days clean, right? When I had 3 days clean, this guy came up to me and he said, "Jojo, if you want to stay clean in Narcotics Anonymous, there's three things you got to do. Don't get high. Don't get high, and don't get high." With 3 days clean, this was the most brilliant man that I've ever met, because he made the most sense out of anybody. So if you're here today and you're high, or you were high last week, or you're on methadone, or you're on Suboxone, or you don't know what you want to do, stay clean today. Don't get high. If you're here today, bring the body in. Eventually, if you stay around long enough, the mind will follow. My name's Jojo. I'm an addict. Thank you very much.